Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast, with me, Nathan Alexander, and my co-host, Todd Tavares. This podcast moves beyond questions of God's existence to ask, what's next in a godless world? If you're enjoying the show so far, remember to like and subscribe, rate and review, and consider supporting us on Patreon. Beyond Atheism is produced and distributed by Atheist United Studios.
Today on Beyond Atheism, we try to lighten up a little bit. Let's now turn our attention from the plight of the godless to how American secular pop culture is in part rooted in a distinct cultural tradition. That said, we would try to lighten up. To help us, we're joined by one of the hosts of Amusing Jews, Jonathan Friedman. New to AU Studios, Amusing Jews is an interview podcast celebrating Jewish contributors and their contributions to American popular culture. Jonathan Friedman, PhD, is a professor of Jewish music history and dean of the Master of Jewish Studies programs at the Academy for Jewish Religion, California, president of the Western States Jewish History Association, and a community leader for the only congregation for humanistic Judaism in Los Angeles. Jonathan, that is a lot. Welcome to Beyond Atheism.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's just amazing you found any free time.
Well, for you, you know.
thanks, Jonathan. Yeah, we really appreciate it. I guess for the opening question, a lot of the people we've talked to on the podcast have come from Christian backgrounds, and we've heard their stories of kind of leaving the religion. And I wonder if you could talk about your own religious background, and if there was a similar kind of like story of losing your faith or whatever. I don't know, how would you describe your religious or cultural journey, I guess?
That's a fantastic question. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately as I'm sort of hitting the midlife crisis phase of my life and figuring things out as some of us do. What I will say is, as a Jewish person, the expectations of faith and belief are not quite as heavy. Certainly in my experience, living on the kind of liberal end of the Jewish spectrum, growing up in a kind of nominally reform household where we never talked about God. I think we laughed more about the concept than took it seriously if the concept ever came up. So you do find, for lack of a better term, Jewish atheists, Jewish agnostics in mainstream Jewish denominations, because Judaism itself as a lived experience is really all-encompassing. It's a culture, it's an ethnicity, it's in some ways, a political identity, depending on the phase and sort of what's in the air in terms of the outside perceptions and Jews needing to kind of stick together through thick and thin and that kind of stuff. So there isn't, at least in my experience, the same kind of ostracization for those of us who declare ourselves atheists. As was mentioned, I teach at a seminary that trains rabbis and cantors. And in full transparency, often, and the students know me well enough, most of them who've been there long enough know me well enough, but I will begin a class saying, hey, this is who I am. I'm a humanist. I'm an atheist. I'm secular. I'm just like most Jews that you'll ever meet, actually. And most Jews that a Jewish leader will serve are kind of more like me than more traditionalist or more religious in that sense. So to answer your question, I actually have never believed in whatever God is. That concept never appealed to me. I never needed it, really, from birth. So I don't really know what it's like to be a believer in that sense. I believe in other things, but not that stuff. So in the Jewish world, I can be a fully functioning, leader, academic, whatever. I'm employed in Jewish organizations. That's kind of all I do. And yet that faith part is not necessary. And that's more normal than it might seem at first glance,
So, I mean, you mentioned this, the spectrum of Judaism, and there is the other side, right? From Reform, and I'm assuming, from Reform to Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox. Where does humanistic Judaism fit? Does it fit in the spectrum? Is it off spectrum, or is it still like part of this continuum?
Yeah, that is a debate that different Jewish communities have had at different times. So here's how I would kind of understand it. And I can only speak for myself, not for the movement. The denominations, whether it's Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, other more conventional mainstream Jewish options, as it were, they are all theistic in one way or another, at least on paper. When you go to a service in a Reform congregation, it's God this, God that, same as it would be in an Orthodox setting. Of course, the whole milieu is very different in terms of men and women sitting together and egalitarian stuff happening in the Reform and much more contemporary. And then on the more right wing of Orthodoxy, very little of that, right? But nevertheless, the bulk of the prayers, theologically, pretty consistent. Of course, with variations in terms of gender neutral language and such, but still theistic. So in that sense, humanistic Judaism is an outlier. We have non-theistic ceremonies. There are boards of rabbis, for instance, around the country that will not accept humanistic rabbis as members or won't accept them without a lot of hemming and hawing and debate and that kind of thing. But in terms of like the role that we serve denominationally or communally within this Jewish spectrum, it's sort of like a place for Jews who are more, well, I don't want to be judgmental, who are Jews who are firm believers that they should be saying things that they believe, if that makes sense, as opposed to kind of paying lip service. So where there might be atheists, and there are, I can tell you, my history with different communities affirms this, there are atheists even among the Orthodox, as strange as that sounds. But the humanistic community attracts those who don't really just want to repeat the traditions because, or the formulas of prayer because that's what their grandparents did or their parents did. They actually want to be authentic. Right. So it's kind of a middle ground for people who still want to celebrate holidays and don't want to be completely alienated from Jewish, like, ceremonial life, if that makes sense. It's a place for basically secular Jews to celebrate Jewish holidays and customs and that kind of stuff, but do it in a non-theistic, truthful way. That they can also, they don't have the need to kind of rationalize what they're doing, if that makes sense. So it's a tributary, it's not a mainstream.
Yeah.
If we want to put it that way.
So one of the things we've seen both in like atheist groups and talking to people involved in humanism is that it's drawing in a lot of people who have left a faith or left like very strong faiths, particularly like evangelicals or LDS. Even like strict Muslims, people leave that. They lost all their social capital. They're trying to rebuild. They want a community. They want to be an active part of it. And they gravitate towards humanism. Whether or not they stick is a different story. But I'm curious if this organization serves that sort of same need of rebuilding a community? And if it does, it, where does it draw from? Is it people like you who were raised without theism, or is it people who are both, or is it a mix? How does this, what's the community like there?
Yeah, I think you'll find within any Jewish community, I would hesitate to say any human community, you have a lot of diversity in terms of background and why people are attracted to this or that, whether it's becoming more religious, less religious, kind of sticking with what they grew up with. So we definitely have a lot of that. Some of our members kind of grew up completely secular. That is, you know, never really having a meal for Passover, a Seder, as we call it, but wanting to kind of experience it, but not wanting to go the theological route and kind of going with the more conventional ceremony. And they found us that way. So in that sense, they're becoming more, for lack of a better term, religious by joining this humanistic group. On the other hand, we have people who absolutely were raised in a more conservative environment, who kind of left that, again, usually without the same kind of alienation and family turmoil as you might see in the LDS and other examples you mentioned. But again, not wanting to leave it entirely. So this is a safe landing place. And then I would say there's a third kind of category. There are probably more than that, but third comes to mind, which is Jews who just want to learn stuff. So a lot of our programming is cultural programming. Last week, we went to the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, right, for the day, just to see the cool exhibits and kind of do a... I presented it as kind of like a scavenger hunt. Look for the Jewish names in the exhibits, you know, because that's kind of what our podcast is about too, kind right. of highlighting the Jewish contributors, as was mentioned. So like there's a lot of energy around that stuff. And to some extent, that kind of programming actually attracts more people. When we show a movie, when we talk about, you know, the history of Broadway or vaudeville or whatever it might be, a lot of people are interested in that, and then they don't show up to the ceremonial stuff. So it's kind of a cultural community in the sense of these are Jewish people, some actually not Jewish as well, who just want to learn about Jewish culture, you know, the history of Jews in Los Angeles or whatever the topic might be of that day. And the ceremonial stuff is somewhat downplayed, and that's partly my choice because I'm not so inclined to ceremony and ritual personally. I'll help other people through it, but if I had my choice, I probably wouldn't partake, you know, independently. So part of that's my own kind of hang up, I guess, on that realm. I'm even more secular than my congregants, if that makes sense.
All right. Yes. Right. Yeah. Well, you mentioned about your podcast that you host, Amusing Jews. It's probably
a good chance to segue
into that. can you talk to us about, well, how did you come to host the podcast, or like what sort of sparked the idea for you?
Yeah, terrific question. I think this was kind of like a long time coming for me as an academic as well. My interests in the past several years, also kind of amplified by the pandemic and having a lot of time to watch movies and stuff like that, has really veered away from the kind of my main field, which is Jewish music history, Jewish musicology, looking at synagogue music and its history and variations. I mean, that's still an expertise, but, you know, moving more into the pop culture realm with comic books and movies and television and that kind of stuff. It's kind of an outgrowth of that, I think, on one hand, like my interests have just shifted a little bit intellectually or academically. But also with that shift, I've come to realize like what is really important to me. You know, throughout my training, throughout my experience, these kinds of things have always been more important to me than quote unquote religion or spirituality. I get my spirituality from reading a good book, or from watching a great episode of a TV show or something like that. Those are my highs. Those are my peak experiences. So kind of embracing that and sharing with others, because I know I'm not alone in that. And also, it was a couple of years ago now, at the school where I teach, the Academy for Jewish Religion, every year we have a retreat and people share songs, and there's like a cabaret kind of experience where people do shows and stuff. And, you know, I thought, hey, why don't I do something different? This was all on Zoom because it was during the pandemic. So I decided to kind of show off some of my stuff that I had around my desk, as I know you can see and the listeners can't. No. Collect things, right?
Yes.
So, you know, video games. Ralph Baer was the inventor of the home video game system, happened to be Jewish, right? Like, there's a Jewish story behind so many of the things that I've always appreciated. So during this cabaret experience, instead of singing a song or, you know, reading a poem or something, I just showed off what I called in that moment my museum of alternative Judaica, meaning like things that are Jewish, but it's not as obvious as like a Star of David or a menorah or something like that. So I showed, you know, little toys and comic books and other things that are near and dear to my heart. I have an autograph. It's actually a business card from Levi Strauss of the famous jeans, right? So his hand signature. Like, I showed that kind of stuff off. And these are the important Judaica objects to me. So, I mean, a long answer, but basically that kind of stuff is really exciting to me and really fun. And, you know, that's the surface level. I think underneath that, what I'm kind of getting at with my work is the through line with all of these innovations and contributions is you have a population that has always been small and marginalized, kind of wandering around on the fringes and making the best of it, right? So Hollywood comes out of an experience of being disenfranchised and not allowed to participate in the elite industries. So you get pushed into the disreputable entertainment industry and build it up into something that everyone is envious about. This happens with the pushcart salesmen who develop department stores and all that kind of stuff too. And popular music develops the same way. So a lot of it is like inspirational stories of even my own like family ancestors who have done the same thing to kind of make their way in the world, and in so doing kind of brighten everyone's lives in the process.
Yeah. There's something that like I can't quite put my finger on, and I find it absolutely fascinating because like, I recently found out like my hometown was the birthplace of the Bathtub Mary. And the Bathtub Mary is you take a bathtub, an old bathtub, and you stand it up, right? And you bury half of it. So you get like a shell and you put a statue of Mary in it. And it's an incredibly common like yard decoration, if you can call it that. They're not the best. So there are these old cast iron tubs that are sticking out of the ground and you put Mary in it. And it's a very Portuguese American thing, right? That's kind of what it was, the communities that started sprouting up in, the people who did it. And it spread. And now I live in a neighborhood where, I mean, all that time moving around so much, and I end up in a place that has bathtub Marys everywhere. But the weird thing about this is that it's distinctly Catholic. Right. There's not really necessarily anything Portuguese about it. It's big in Portuguese communities, but it's also very Catholic. And those two things are very, very easily divisible. Right. And it's suddenly, well, OK, like there is this very Portuguese contribution to Catholicism, but it's not itself necessarily Portuguese American. But a lot of the things on the flip side is a lot of the things that you're talking about are things that are just like very American. You're talking about American culture, right? If we're talking about the art of stand-up, right, it comes from mostly Jews, correct? Right? Like if we're talking about...
Yeah, like Jewish vaudevillian comedians and all
that. Catskills.
Yeah.
If we're talking about like American popular music and looking at Bob Dylan, if we go to punk and talk about Joey Ramone, like it's so diverse as well, but it's also like from our eyes, from our perspective, a secular perspective, there's nothing that's distinctly Jewish about it per se, correct?
Yeah, that is a great observation. And this is a complicated subject. But I think Mel Brooks, you know, another amazing Jewish contributor, and, you know, a shaper of American popular culture, with Spaceballs and Blazing Saddles and all of that stuff. He puts it this way. He says there's a certain Jewish je ne sais quoi, right? You can't really put your finger on it, but it's apparent to anyone who kind of knows the subtext, the kind of unspoken. It feels Jewish, all of that stuff, actually, to a Jewish person who's kind of tapped into that culture. I think Seinfeld, the television program, is a great example of that, where, you know, the word Jew might have been used a couple of times in the many, many seasons, but these characters weren't Jewish. You know, they were kind of just presented as characters. But if, from a Jewish viewpoint, that show is like the most Jewish thing that was ever on television. And it's the, like, it's the subtext. It's the way that people talk to each other. It's the references. You know, Superman is Jewish. Jerry Seinfeld had Superman on his mantle next to his DVDs or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of I don't know what you would call them. Easter egg doesn't sound right, but you know what I'm saying? Little Passover eggs.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah. But, you know, again, like looking at that from a broader cultural perspective, it's often said that the je ne sais quoi, the kind of the it factor, the thing that we can kind of sense, is a people who are kind of on the margins, as I mentioned, at least in the earlier phases. And I think even to this day, we can make the argument, who are making observations from the sidelines about kind of American culture and American populations and so forth, in their own kind of desire to become Americanized. Certainly that's true of Jewish ancestors in America, but kind of noting, oh, there's that and there's that. But also there's like this satirical streak, right, to kind of make fun of all this stuff too. But, you know, ultimately when you say that, and I think it's correct, that we're talking about music, movies, these things are just kind of generically American from, I think, any perspective. But knowing that they come from, or were at least kind of instigated by Jewish people, I think shows that this project of Americanization was really successful. So much so that the Jews shaped the culture even as they were trying to kind of find their place in it, right? So talking about Tin Pan Alley, Hollywood, Broadway, comic book heroes, you know, the entire Marvel universe, right? All of that stuff is essentially a Jewish creation. But again, it's like from an outsider looking in kind of perspective. It's again, difficult to put your finger on, but, you know, if you look hard enough, you can find it.
Yeah, and that really clarifies it, because and there is definitely that two-way road to it, because I can see it in something like the Three Stooges, which is like, it's quintessentially American now at this point. And there's definitely a straight line from there to like Dumb and Dumber, and like Jim Carrey, although he's Canadian, but we'll bring him into the discussion for the sake of argument here. Like it's very much that's been adopted, right? The old vaudeville became very American. Other Americans adopt it. I don't have any further observation.
Yeah.
Unless there's more you want to say.
Can I say something about the Three Stooges? Yeah. I mean, there were six of them in total, and five of them were Jewish, but we don't have to get into the
biographies. Was it Curly Joe? Because he's not no good.
Right. Yeah. Okay. He was the tail end. But, you know, what's interesting about them, you know, 1940, before, you know, the United States entered World War II, before even Charlie Chaplin made The Great Dictator, the Three Stooges made a short, you know, one of their classic shorts, which was You Nazi Spy. You can look it up on YouTube. It's really quite wonderful. But they're lampooning and denigrating the, you know, the Nazi regime. This is way before that was even okay in Hollywood. Hollywood was very careful about these kinds of subject matters. But they were doing that from a Jewish perspective. It's pretty clear. They throw in a couple of Hebrew phrases in that in that sketch. They even elsewhere use Yiddish, kind of, again, for someone who's familiar with the sound, we kind of get the joke. There's a short where they're kind of hiding from the police, and they dress up as, you know, unfortunately, stereotypical Chinese men kind of on the streets of New York. And the cop comes to them and says, "Hey, where are you from?" And they start talking in Yiddish, right, to kind of be a foreign language. You know, there's all these kinds of things, even in there, very broad, very like even non-linguistic humor. It's all kind of body humor, slapstick. There are so many Jewish elements. And even I would say the thing I appreciate most about the Three Stooges, and I apologize whenever someone mentions the Three Stooges, I can go on and on. but their physiques, you know, this kind of, I think the tallest one was maybe Shemp at 5'5", 5'6", or something like that. But they were all short guys, short and stout. They look like my ancestors who came over from Eastern Europe. You know, and they played up that idea or that comedy. They would always have like the bad guys, these really tall, slender actors to kind of make them look even sillier as these Stooges characters. But all of that to me is like so obviously Jewish, everything that they were doing. And that's in the DNA of American humor for sure. As maybe our parents might have done, we can sort of dismiss the Three Stooges as stupid or lowbrow. But I think time has shown that that stuff is actually much more sophisticated than we might give credit. Right.
So it sounds like it's a real, there's an out-group that's sort of making something for the in-group. And the in-group takes it on as part of their culture without recognizing that out-group culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think the greatest testament to that is Christmas music.
Yeah.
All those holiday songs that everyone knows, the secular ones, right? So the ones Rudolph, about Santa Claus and Rudolph and all that stuff, all Jewish. You know, look at a top 10 list of like favorite Christmas songs. 8 or 9 of those are going to be, or maybe even 10, depending on the list, are going to be written by Jews. And part of that is like what you're saying, finding a way into this culture, but in the process, secularizing what was originally a very superstitious, very religious, very kind of dark holiday and making it fun for everyone. You know, surveys on Christmas observance in America shows that many more people celebrate Christmas than there are Christians in America. So it's not really a religious holiday. Yeah. And Christians might complain about that.
Oh, they do.
They might even blame the Jews for it. And look, it's true. I mean, the Jews were the Jews had the department stores, and that's where all that kind of decoration and the kind of promotions around Christmas sit on Santa Claus's lap and all that stuff. Jews invented that stuff, you know. So the commercial secular kind of something for everyone, happy holiday stuff, that may be the number one Jewish contribution to American culture. We can make the argument in terms of like the most obvious, the most explicit, sort of overt, in your face Jewish contribution. If you've been you know, anywhere in the States around December, or even really starting after
Halloween,
I think now. Yeah. It's Jewish stuff everywhere. Mm. You know what I mean?
Right.
We just don't recognize it as
but
such.
This is that observation that you've put forth, that like this sort of assimilation, even through entertainment, various forms of entertainment or commercial activity, or just like people trying to integrate, it has this secularizing process. That's a pretty wild thing to find. And does it have the sort of same impact going the other direction onto Judaism? Did that weaken what theism there was in Judaism?
To an extent, the American project, as it were, was a liberating phase in Jewish history. So I would say it's not unique to Jews in the sense of the immigrant generation comes. They were raised in the old country. They bring their own baggage, their own history, their own culture, their own language. then their children kind of rebel against that. And, you know, it's the jazz singer from 1927, which just went into public domain, right. You know? Mm-hmm. But that story kind of played out in many different ways, maybe minus the blackface, maybe including it sometimes. We don't have to get into that. Different times. But, you know, the idea that the opportunities in America were incredibly novel in the sense that you have this repressed socioeconomic, political condition that Jews are living under in the Pale of Settlement in Eastern Europe. They come to America and now we can succeed. It's sort of like when you think about migration, human migration, whether it's explicit or, you know, a number two or three reason, economics is a factor always, right? So a lot of scholars are starting to look at Jewish migration during this period, and it's roughly like the 1880s to 1924 when you have this massive wave of Eastern European Jews coming to America, about 2.3 million or so, amidst about 20 million immigrants in total. It was just a big wave of immigration from Europe. A lot of scholars had historically looked at this as people escaping pogroms and people escaping persecution of a more violent kind. But more and more, we're starting to come to terms with the notion that these are economic migrants, right? Who are coming to America. And part of that economic motivation is, you know, finding a living wherever you can, right? So again, kind of the vaudeville into Broadway, into Hollywood, kind of that whole phenomenon, that makes a lot of sense. And in order to go from point A to point B, you change your last name. You start to adopt African-American music as your own because they're African-Americans are seen as indigenous Americans. And you want to kind of actually in some way celebrate. It's really odd to say, but when Jews did blackface, the story is that they did it much more sensitively than the kind of angry Anglos, you know what I mean? So like Al Jolson had a lot of black fans, you know, but part of that again is like, how do you fast track to becoming an American? You put on disguises, you change your name, you start to imitate and even poke fun at yourself. There were Jewish entertainers on vaudeville who made fun of old fashioned Jews. They put on what was called Jew face, where they would put like putty on their noses and, you know, kind of exaggerate their features and speak in a broken Yiddish and all that kind of stuff to kind of prove to the audience that's how we used to be. We can make fun of it now because we're moving forward into this American project. So it's very complicated on some level, but in some ways, I think we do see this with immigrants and the children of immigrants. And what happens like later on in the 1960s and 70s with ethnic pride movements that will emerge, that are not, you know, restricted to like the, you know, Black Pride or, you know, what was called Red Pride, Native American Pride, Chicano Pride, all of that stuff. There was Jewish Pride and other kind of white, quote unquote, ethnic pride movements as well. You know, retrieving your Italian heritage, all that kind of stuff. And Jews certainly benefited from that in the sense of, you know, maybe we discarded too much in this process. Maybe we can retrieve a proud Jewish identity. Maybe we can start making stuff that's actually explicitly Jewish again and not just write Christmas music. You know, maybe we can sprinkle in some Judaism into our work. Leonard Cohen and people like that sort of making references to their, you know, their Jewish heritage without fear of alienation and that kind of thing. So it kind of goes in waves. And I think, you know, my program, the Amusing Jews program, it's kind of a next phase of that. Like, okay, let's take a retrospective look and see that all of this stuff is Jewish, whether explicitly or implicitly. And let's get some guests on the show and talk to them about how their Jewish identity maybe is reflected in their work, whether they're working in video games or in, you know, reality television or whatever it might be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of archaeology, of finding like this stuff has always been there. It's always there. It's just under the surface. And you have to know what you're looking for and what you're looking at.
Right. And kind of who's doing the looking, right? Because I'm fully aware that, as I sometimes say, you know, I'm a Jew, so everything I do is Jewish. Everything I see is Jewish. Every time I eat, you know, a piece of candy, that candy turns Jewish because I'm the one who ate it, you know? it's that kind of self-awareness, right? I think, too.
But that also leads into, like, cultural formation, because then you get things like Festivus, which, just like you said, right, it's coming from Seinfeld. It's not Jewish. I don't think, I mean, it's Jewish in the sense, like you said, about eating candy. It's that sense. But it's not this recreation of temple, right? It's not Seder. It's not lighting candles on Hanukkah. It's creating something that's very different from very traditional roots, but something that is sort of secularized and universal.
Yeah. And I know that I'm not a real expert on the history of Festivus, because one of the writers of the episode actually kind of drew on his own family tradition. I guess his dad or something was really opposed to the commercialization of the holidays and invented Festivus for the family. And then it became this episode, and now it's a real thing on December 23rd. But I think because it was, you know, Jerry Stiller and that whole kind of milieu that presented Festivus to us, I see it as very Jewish. And I will even say that the elements of Festivus, whether they started out Jewish or not, I mean, the idea of, like, the airing grievances, I mean, that's all we do. Yeah. You know what I mean? That, I know it's not a explicitly or I should say exclusively Jewish thing, but that's any Jewish meal ever, you know? The feats of strength to kind of prove that you're not just some academic schlub, that you got some moxie, you know?
Yeah.
That's like this inferiority complex that a lot of Jews have too. I mean, we could definitely go down the list of elements of the holiday.
The drabness. You recognize part of yourself when you watch things like that.
Absolutely. The drabness of the pole, right? Like that's to me like a comment on sometimes the plainness, the plain aesthetic that is sometimes preferred in Jewish settings as well. So all I'm saying is a Jew looking at Festivus, it becomes a Jewish holiday, at least for me. And I celebrate Festivus in one way or another. I try to.
Don't we all every day try to celebrate Festivus?
Yeah, there you go.
I actually had a sort of question going on a tangent from that. It's just a small question. Like, on Seinfeld, are the Costanzas supposed to be Jewish? Like, I think there's some debate about that, like whether they're supposed to. I mean, they have this Italian name, but
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the codedness of it all, right? Because apparently George Costanza is Larry David. Yeah. Like, that's his avatar, right? And then, of course, you have these very Jewish parents, but they're not explicitly overtly Jewish. I mean, you could say maybe they're Italian Jews, or, you know, they have some kind of Sephardic ancestry. I mean, I've read different kind of rationalizations of it. But I think part of the joke, part of the joke, I think, I think all of this is intentional. Maybe one day I'll have Larry David on my show to clear up this stuff. But, you know, the idea that you have like this very Jewish nebbish kind of character, nebbish just meaning kind of like, well, it's hard to define, but like a Woody Allen-ish, you know, insecure, hemming and hawing kind of character, who's got an Italian name. That's hilarious, right? Uh-huh. That to me is funny. And that must have been intentional.
Yeah, that's one that I was actually talking to someone about that today. And trying to make, we could not make sense of it that way. And they do something like that in, actually now that we've had this conversation, we can reflect on some of it. Like you were saying, you put on different names, you put on disguises, and then you, right, to blend in. And I think they did something similar with Rachel in Friends, where it's Rachel Green, it's hiding in plain sight, but it's never mentioned, it's never addressed. It's always that she's probably Jewish, let's never talk about it.
Right, and I've never seen Friends.
You're not missing anything.
I remember back in high school when those shows were kind of competing against each other on NBC. There was like the Friends crowd and the Seinfeld crowd, and I was the leader of the Seinfeld group. And we sort of made a pact never to watch this program.
Wow.
So I don't know much about Friends other than the theme song, which was written by a Jew. But nevertheless,
I'm amazed of your commitment to hold strong to that pledge that you made 30 years ago.
Yes. Well, part of it is just knowing what you kind of alluded to, that I'm not really missing much to begin with.
Yeah. So. It's an easy thing to miss, and you're not. There's no loss. Which I think that does get to a point, like getting someone like Larry David. That's phenomenal. But who have you had on so far, and who do you plan to bring on in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's not, you know, beyond the realm of possibility to get someone of that caliber. Kind of starting the show is, I think, any podcast or any this kind of like grassroots program would do. Starting with people we know, and then kind of expanding from there and reaching out to people that they may know. And once you get enough, hopefully we'll get enough of a following that people will be delighted to come on the show. But so the first guest that we had, good friend of mine, Harris Shore, who was actually a bit character on Seinfeld. He was the original Mr. Lippman, who's Elaine's boss. He will be replaced in later episodes by another actor playing the same character. But nevertheless, the cool thing about Harris, in addition to that, is he was on the original Donkey Kong commercials for, you know, like pre-Nintendo, early 1980s. And he was the first live-action Mario.
Wow.
Right? So he was the first actor to portray Mario.
And that was live-action, so, not you know, just the voice?
Right. So he was, you know, in the commercial playing the game on his home video system. And, you know, the great ape was behind him and all that stuff as he's playing. Fun stuff. So he was our first guest. The second guest that we had, voice actress primarily, Rena Strober, who was a voice on Sailor Moon, a very popular anime cartoon, the American, you know, version of that, among many other things as well, Broadway, et cetera, et cetera. So just to give kind of a couple examples, we have, I think our next episode will feature Michael Elias, who's a screenwriter. He wrote The Jerk with Steve Martin, and also The Frisco Kid with Gene Wilder, and other kind of classics from that era. He was also the showrunner and creator of Head of the Class, if you ever watched that sitcom back in the day. Friend of mine also. So like starting with really cool people that I happen to know, and then, you know, the ball is rolling. We have guests lined up for the next few months, and you know, there's really no shortage of possible people. Because and by the way, like part of it is highlighting, part of me wants to highlight the people that we might not know as well, right? Like the people who aren't household names, like the character actors and the voice actors and the screenwriters who often play second or third or fourth fiddle to the director, right? Or, you know, the producer of a reality show, or the editor of a documentary series. These kinds of people interest me a lot, the people behind the scenes. I've always kind of been a behind the scenes person myself, and sort of felt a lot of kindred spirit with others in that way. And then knowing, on the other hand, that to get clicks and all that stuff, we probably need to get Steven Spielberg on at some point, you know? So it's kind of having it both ways. And that's what we aspire to do, kind of keep an eclectic blend of different contributors in different areas and learn about their craft and their experiences. Again, the lesser known people who maybe won't get those obvious clicks, but I think who, if you give them a chance, what they have to say is really remarkable.
Yeah, and it sounds like it really matches with what you're trying to do, which is find something that's part of the everyday life of both of entertainers and of Jews, right? And how that culture shapes their work and how the work shapes the culture, I suppose, as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds like it's off to a great start already.
Yeah, I think so. I've been very pleased. You know, we're upgrading some of our technical stuff, which is always an issue, as I'm sure you know. But
yeah, we know really well.
But we're headed in the right direction, and there's a lot of nice warm feelings coming at us. So absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think it's been really interesting listening to the first couple episodes. Yeah, like the first guest you mentioned, Harris Shor. It was really interesting looking up that ad. He was in like the original Mario. It's so interesting looking at it now. I guess it was in the early 80s. I mean, now that like the sort of Mario character has been kind of well defined now, to see how it was, you know, just in its infancy, how it was portrayed. Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, and to think of an actor who's coming into this role about, you know, because it was a role for him in this commercial, not knowing anything about this game or this thing. I mean, to even put your mind around the period when Mario was not known.
Yeah.
Was not even, like you said, a formed character. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I guess there's no way to know that this would be like the most iconic video game character ever. Probably. I mean, yeah, no, it's really
cool. And he's a proto Costanza. Yeah. Jewish playing an Italian.
Right. There you go. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Nathan, do you have more questions? I mean, Jonathan, to be honest, I could ask a lot more, but we're on the clock here. Nathan, yeah. Should we move into the lightning round or should we have more?
Let's do it. Yeah. And let's save some good stuff for the bonus.
Yeah,
section.
That's right. That's where we keep all the good stuff, people.
Yeah.
So the lightning round is usually can a true atheist, but I think we're going to have to modify it for you. Jonathan, what would be better? Can a true secular Jew or can a true humanist Jew? Or should it even be or a true amusement?
I think maybe. Oh, I like that one.
amusing Jew.
Yeah, I maybe vary it, you know, with the different, if you're going to ask the same kind of formula over and over, you can mix it up. I'm many different.
Okay, and there's no right or wrong answer here.
Yeah.
It's all opinion based. It's yes or no questions. You can answer, you can expand upon your answer and for as much as you like. And yeah, it's not meant to be a getcha one. But we'll start with one, a getcha one. Can a true humanist Jew believe in God?
I'm going to say no, only because you said true. Mm. But
yes,
and this is the problem. Like another Jewish thing is answering a question with a question, and like it's an endless thing. But I'll try to keep it short. There are people in my community and in my experience who align with secular humanistic Judaism who have a belief in something, maybe akin to the Force in Star Wars or some greater sort of energy that they're connecting to. And I'm reminded of Eric Fromm, the psychologist philosopher. He would talk about himself as a non-theistic mystic, right? So he had this kind of connection to the universe. He didn't want to call it God, but he also wasn't that uncomfortable using that as a metaphor. So I guess the answer is sort of.
Pretty good.
Perfect.
You know how to play this game well. Have you done this before?
Yes. Yeah. All right. I'm going to say, can a true amusing Jew complain that Seinfeld isn't funny?
I'm going to say no. And here's the thing. Seinfeld, the comedian, right? So, and there's no real distinction between the character he played on the show. He's not really an actor. And the person he is as a person, I guess the true test about, you know, are you really an amusing Jew or someone who kind of gets it, which is probably what that means. I'm going to probably butcher this, but he said the funniest joke that he ever heard goes like this. So there's two Gentile businessmen, Wall Street, encounter each other on the street. One says, "How's business?" The other one says, "Great. How about you?" The guy says, "Great." I know it doesn't make sense,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the fact is they must be Gentiles. They must be non-Jews if business is great, right?
I see.
Okay. So it's that complaining thing that I mentioned before, right? It's like a very subtle joke.
Yeah.
And I think if you get that joke, you're kind of in the club, right? You know what I mean? Mm. And there are a lot of Jews who don't get that joke either. Mm. I'll admit it. But if to be an amusing Jew, it is to find a joke like that funny.
Right.
So if you're not finding Seinfeld to be a funny show, then maybe you can still be Jewish. It's just you're not really in that kind of zone, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Yes, and well played with the semantics, by the way. Define every word in the sentence and then get there, and that's fantastic. Okay, can a true humanist Jew, back to that, keep a kosher diet or otherwise follow religious laws?
Yes, and the reason for that is these are, from a certain perspective, divorced from divine command, depending on your perspective. So the mitzvot, which are, you know, you've probably heard of bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, that word mitzvah means commandment. So historically, this means things that God commands you to do, you don't have a choice in the matter. From a humanistic perspective, we still use that terminology, but we understand it more in the sense of like responsibility, you know, you're living your truth, that kind of stuff. So keeping a kosher diet is a signifier of Jewish identity, right? What was the other part of the question? Going to synagogue?
No, or any other religious. I think that was just the point there, just to say.
Yeah, so you can absolutely, you know, avoid certain foods, you know, only eat certain foods on certain days, that kind of stuff, if that's an expression of your identity. And I would say that, you know, just knowing the demography of Jews, a lot of people who are keeping kosher are not doing it because God will punish them if they don't. They're doing it because they want to kind of express their Jewishness in the things that they do, if that makes sense. So it's really a cultural, ethnic menu.
Is there a lot of overlap? And are there things that you maintain through the community? You'd have to imagine, like, I don't really know any of that. And I know it's not, you're not going with the traditional garb. You're not wearing the scarves. It looks like you cut the hair above your temples. But are there other aspects other than kosher that people try to maintain either for holidays or for ritual?
Yeah, right.
Something like that.
Yeah, so we will still, you know, light the candles if we're doing a Shabbat ceremony or Hanukkah or whatever it might be, the kind of signature foods that you would find at a Passover Seder. We have all that stuff, but the difference is in the interpretation, right? So in the kind of generic conventional Jewish framework, you have these formulaic blessings that always, you know, thank God for this or bless God for that. We just change the language, right? You know, we say, you know, how... or blessed is the light in the world instead of blessed is God, right? That kind of stuff. And kind of like making it more, I guess, scientific, humanistic, more realistic, as it were. You know, thanking the people who brought us this food instead of thanking God for the food, that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you know, in terms of the artifacts or the paraphernalia that we might use in such a situation, it will look the same. We could use the same candles, we can use the same, you know, Seder plates, but it's what we interpret that is different.
Can a true humanistic Jew refuse to identify as Jewish?
Actually, technically, no. Humanistic Judaism as a movement actually has a definition of Jew, which is really expansive, much more so than other denominations, because there isn't that kind of religious litmus test. Essentially, anyone who wants to identify as a Jew is welcome to do so from a humanistic perspective, because it is more of a cultural identity and less of a, well, who is your mother? And did you do the conversion the proper way and that kind of stuff? So I think on the surface, you kind of have to acknowledge and identify your Jewishness as a starting point. You know, you could be a humanist, but can you be a humanistic Jew, you know, if you don't have the Jew part? But I will say this too, just since you brought it up, there is debate even in my community. Are we Jews who happen to be humanists, or are we humanists who happen to be Jews? You know, like which takes priority? And certainly one side or the other might get upplayed or downplayed depending on the individual. So it's it's not at all a frivolous question. It's a good question.
No, but it also sounds like it's something that's not really determined yet. I get the sense that, like, if you get the further down the line you go, once you get to orthodoxy, you know exactly what you are. But in your position, that it's something that's still being formed, or it's it can sort of mutate and take a new shape.
Absolutely. And I think each community, you know, we've resisted as a movement to have a singular, like, prayer book that everyone uses, or ceremony book, if a lot of people don't like the word prayer because it's non-theistic. But nevertheless, the communities themselves sort of have autonomy to create their own services and how they want to express themselves for whatever it might be. And being on the West Coast, and also being myself, again, I'm sometimes more liberal and secular and progressive than my congregants. It, my community is kind of, in some ways, a reflection of me. You know, like, I get to shape it in a very intimate way. And so that's true for any humanistic Jewish community. And some are more conservative, if that makes sense, than others in terms of trying to retain traditional elements or keep the kind of conventional schedule of programming around the holidays or whatever it might be. I'm really loose when it comes to that kind of stuff. So I think, to your point, there is a resistance to kind of making those kind of hard line definitions and saying, well, you're this and you're not. And one of the major rabbis in the movement, Adam Shalom, he talks about how it's really counterproductive to be an ethnic bouncer, meaning like you're checking the Jewish identity of everyone as they come through the door. Yeah, you can come through, you can't. Why even play that game? Right. You know, if someone wants to be here,
yes,
that's great. Yeah. You know, we're a small movement. We can use all the help we get, you know? Mm-hmm.
I know. Mm-hmm. You say that, and I like that you phrase it as a game, because we are literally playing as gatekeepers right now, asking, can you be a...
That's right, yeah.
I forgot we're playing that game. Yeah.
That's exactly what we're doing. But, we've come to the realization that it's a game, it's all phony, it's all posturing until that we get together and actually become the thing that we are. Which is, here's another one then. Can a true amusing Jew, we'll switch back to that one, celebrate Christmas with their children?
Absolutely.
Really? Oh, that's fantastic. That's
easy. I do it. Yeah. Well, and I will say that, I know we don't need to expand on every answer, but the Christmas thing is really interesting. I grew up in a household with two Jewish parents, both of whom were familiar with Christmas from their backgrounds. And we grew up with Christmas, and it was always Santa Claus is coming and that kind of stuff. Certainly not Christian, right? But really the secular Christmas, and growing up and maturing and kind of learning that secular Christmas is at least in some ways a Jewish holiday created by Jews. I mean, it's just another opportunity to celebrate my Jewishness.
Yes.
You know, every time I see Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, it warms the cockles of my heart, you know?
There's a war on Christmas and we're winning. Is that it, Jonathan?
Yeah.
Now, I guess so.
But you wouldn't lead your congregation in this. You wouldn't put a Christmas tree up, or do you?
No, but actually earlier, this is where things get really interesting, and probably not the time to expand too much on the history of all this. But Christmas was very attractive to immigrants, Jewish immigrants who were coming from Eastern Europe. One of the first things that they would do to kind of prove that they were American would be to buy a Christmas tree, which was something they weren't familiar with in Europe and had no idea that this was Christian in any way. They just saw it as an American thing to do in the winter. It's a celebration. And then even the earlier immigrants, before the 1880s from German-speaking lands, from the birthplace of the Christmas tree and all that stuff, they would have Christmas trees to kind of celebrate their Germanness and their ancestry. And these are Jews. So you would have Jewish gatherings at like a Jewish, fraternal organization or whatever. And they would have like legendary Christmas displays and that kind of stuff. So it sounds really bizarre today. And certainly I'm totally sympathetic, and I understand a lot of Jews the majority of Jews who are kind of sick of the whole Christmas thing and have actually elevated Hanukkah to kind of take its place and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, there's a lot of Christianity and it's sometimes very annoying to see all of that, like public displays of crosses and all that stuff. That's always been a difficult thing. But I think from a different perspective, again, that secular Christmas is a very Jewish thing. Mm-hmm. If you have the right attitude. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And the last one, I'm just going to say, can a true Jew, period, can a true Jew lack a sense of humor?
I suppose.
Okay.
I've known some Jews who don't have it. And, mm-hmm. you know, we can interrogate trauma and other aspects that mm-hmm. might play into that. Maybe their aspirations to be white kind of erase mm-hmm. their sense of humor, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it might be. But on the other hand, I think that most Jews think that they're funny, even if they're not. Right. You know, it's kind of like a pathology.
Right.
But does it stem from I've been Jewishness?
Yeah, I think, well, the origins of Jewish humor, that's a subject that's been discussed and studied quite a bit. And again, Mel Brooks is kind of one of the famous articulators of this, not from an academic side, but from like a producer of comedy side, that the sense of humor developed as a defense mechanism, as a way to kind of deal with trauma. So you see this a lot with historically marginalized or persecuted populations. They're known for their humor, right? It's not just Jews, but, you know, African Americans, Native Americans, et cetera. Like the humor is really sophisticated, on point, you know, legendary, all that kind of stuff. So there is such a thing as Jewish humor. Does that mean that every Jew is funny? No. But I don't know if the question was, can you be an amusing Jew and not have a sense of humor? Then it's absolutely.
It was.
Just, I think that's in the definition.
Yeah, that would
amusing.
Yeah.
Amusing implies something yes. comical on some level.
Yes.
Well, that's fantastic, and the show is already fantastic. You have how many episodes? Well, by the time this drops, there'll probably be.
Yeah.
I think more, as of today, you guys have 4. You just kicked off on AU Studios. And you guys get deep, you get interesting, and it's unlike this show. There's a lot more laughter going on.
Yeah,
that'd be having fun.
Yeah,
yeah. That's my goal in life to have fun because, you know, like you said, everything's a game.
Yeah. Any other plugs you want to make, Jonathan? Anything? We can give you the last word. Anything you want to let the
I do want to shout out my co-host. My co-host, Joey Angelfield, who couldn't be here on this interview. He was planning to. Work stuff got in the way. But, you know, the show would be nothing without him. Also, our producer, Mike Tomrin, my best friend since before kindergarten. Amazing engineer, producer for the show. It's really the three of us against the world. And a heck of a lot of fun, like you said. So, you know, if the listeners enjoyed this, I encourage them to check us out, Amusing Jews. It's not just for Jews. We don't even talk about Judaism very much. It's just amusing humans. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So give it a listen. Thanks again, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Jonathan Friedman of Amusing Jews. Todd, what were some of your takeaways from that conversation?
I mean, I have a lot of takeaways. One, like, it's just, I think we started the discussion maybe before we recorded talking about just how curious we were about Judaism. We wanted to learn something, and we learned a ton of stuff, and I love that. Like, it's weird that atheists have a fascination with religion, right? I used to say that atheists are the only people who take religion seriously, which I still kind of believe. But, you know, and it's great to get all these answers, but we need to be a little cautious about it. And Jonathan said it throughout, here and there, that, like, okay, like, this humanist version of Judaism, he accepts it as Judaism. It has all the cultural and all the culture and history and practices and some of the rituals of Judaism. But even, like, if you get to the Orthodox side, they don't consider this to be Judaism. And we need to keep that in mind. It's not the only word on Judaism. It's not the final word. It's a word. It's one interpretation of it.
Yeah.
This is still a very controversial interpretation. Well, with that said, he kept touching on something that, and it's in the background. It's the part of the worldview that I don't think we've ever articulated on the show. And I certainly haven't. Is that like, we don't need a religion. As humans, we don't need a religion. You just don't. I don't know if this has happened to you, but I've certainly heard it in my life, right? Like, how can you be moral without God? We don't need God. How can you be moral without a religion? How can you do the right thing without a religion? How can you learn right from wrong without a religion? You can't be married if it's not in a church. The atheist position on this is very clear. You don't need a religion. You don't need God deciding things for you. When people tell you, God wants you to do this, God wants you to behave in a certain way, we know that that's actually someone, it's another person telling you how to behave. And we don't need that. And it's, you know, and we've seen it in ways that we can divorce. So like talking about bathtub Marys, right? I can be a Portuguese American without having a bathtub Mary. It's fine. It's perfectly easy. But we've also heard it from other people who say, like, without my religion, I don't have a history. I don't have a culture. Right? Like all of my rituals, all of my family gatherings are all based on the religion and being a member of the church. Right? And what Jonathan did really well and what he's constructing and what humanist Judaism does is at least it gives us, if it's not a perfect analog, and I don't think anything is, it shows that, yeah, actually you can reconstruct this without the religious elements. You can remove those and still have something. And what he does with this, like, the archaeology that he's done, the excavating of Jewish culture and how it's permeated into secular society, is he's finding ways where, like, yeah, this is how it happened. And it does it without religion. People contribute to culture, people make their mark, and they do it without religion. And that's great. I think that's an important takeaway for me.
Yeah, I think kind of building off that, one thing he was talking about before we started, and like, I think you were getting some water or something, but like, just about this idea of like religion, it doesn't really, it's more of like a kind of category that comes out of Christianity, and it fits with Christianity better. And I think one thing I found interesting about his kind of biography, I think, is that, you know, a lot of people we talk to, like, they leave Christianity or whatever, then they kind of like reconstruct another kind of set of values or something like that. Whereas with him, that it doesn't seem like there's ever kind of a break, you know, like with his own tradition he was raised in or something like that. And I think like Judaism is, or Jewishness is so complicated because it's like, it's a religion, but it's also like an ethnicity or whatever, you know, with its own like history and culture and so on. So it's really like, you know, again, like maybe it's your point about the bathtub Mary thing where you, it's not divisible like that, where you can say like, okay, this is the sort of cultural aspect or whatever, this is the religious aspect. And I think it does maybe show that the category of religion somewhat breaks down a little bit. Like it doesn't quite fit with, you know, like would you say he's religious? I mean, you know,
that's a good question.
He's like the leader of this congregation. I mean, I mean, like in the sense of like, I guess it depends what you mean by religion, I suppose. But I think like, yeah, the category doesn't quite fit, but I think, yeah, I think obviously you're right that we, at least there's not a need for like any kind of supernatural beliefs to go along with these like rituals and morals and so on and community and stuff.
Yeah, and it's a general statement that's applicable to the world, right? We don't need it, and which is part of the atheist message. Jonathan himself mentioned that he grew up without God, which is interesting in itself. It's like he is not someone who came from a faith per se. And I know it gets more complicated with Judaism and what we talk when we discuss faith. But for him, God was never, I think he mentioned it, that it was never, you know, never something that was brought up, never really part of his belief system. From this, we can dig into things like humanism and what humanism brings and the worldview. And it's very clear, like it's a humanist worldview that shapes it. It's, you know, something that advocates assimilation, something that advocates global mobility of people, free to join and interact with any culture that they, you know, wherever they end up. That's definitely, you can see that, that there's a lot that he's drawing from humanism that is not necessarily found, going to be found in any religion or any anybody who is not humanist. I mean, this this is the thing that we do, Nathan. I don't know if you've noticed this. It starts off being about amusing Jews and how, hey, there's a podcast about funny people doing funny things to entertain us. And we make it all about like belief systems and religion. And-
I found, like on the cultural stuff and this, like just really fascinating, like how, well, he speaks on these issues of like the experience of immigration and being kind of like a marginalized group in society and how this eventually leads them to becoming, you know, like you were saying too, like indistinct from like American, like Jewish culture is American culture. And like, they just kind of just blends in seamlessly now. Like,
just to clarify, statement I was trying to make is that a lot of American culture is, like, has Jewish roots.
And I think the same, like the same could be said with like, you know, African-American culture,
absolutely. Yep.
And
Jonathan discusses that really, really well. And it, you can tell it's really, it comes from part of his perspective on this, right? And that as an out-group, what does the out-group do to become part of the in-group, be accepted by the in-group? How does that shape their behavior? And how does it, you know, I mean, like cultural reproduction, how do you keep creating this in a secular culture? Why is it that this is something that persists? He has a great eye for it, and it's super interesting. And even if, like, in the few podcasts, the few episodes they have up now, while we're doing this, I think there's only been three or four that have been posted. It's a great mix of this, where they actually do talk about entertaining things and like the original equipment. And get that background while dropping in how it relates to this culture, how it makes that move from something that they, the culture they were raised in, and how it informs their work, which is great. It's insightful. I mean, it's, there's going to be something like this is just plain interesting and fun.
Yeah.
Which is a nice thing about theirs. It's actually just
yeah, fun. It's fun. Yes. Yeah. So, we try to be fun too.
We stress on try. Well, okay, here's something fun. Here's another fun thing I liked. I liked Jonathan's perspective that, well, you know what, Jews invented Christmas twice. You know, you got Mary, and Joseph, they invent Christmas, and then come to America 2,000 years later, and it's Jews inventing Christmas.
Yeah, I didn't realize at all about that, like the history of like so much of our kind of cultural associations with Christmas are produced by Jews. Crazy.
Well, Jonathan is picking out, you know, it's a little bit of cherry picking, because the bigger thing is like everybody contributes to it. Everybody did.
Right. That's true. Right? Yeah.
There's not an American group that didn't. So.
Yeah, that's true. You're right.
And that's important to recognize. And it gets weirder still, because you can go, but you can say things like, you know, it's German because the German Christmas tree, and there's, you know, David Graebner, who was an anthropologist. One of the great observations he made was like, just, you know, if you're going to say what America is, it's not really Anglo, it's more German. You get a third of the population is German ethnically. And the biggest foods here are hamburgers and Frankfurters. Right. It's incredibly German. And the Christmas tree is incredibly German. But even inside that, there's that weird transformation. German Americans have the tradition of the pickle. Okay. For a Christmas tree, you hide a pickle ornament on the Christmas tree. And it's like, it's a German American tradition that apparently has no roots in Germany.
Right. Okay.
It's one of those, right? It just doesn't exist in Germany, but German Americans have been so insistent upon it that German ornament manufacturers have now started producing pickles to sell to German Americans. Right. It's so, everything about this is weird. The cultural transmission gets so confusing. Like, you can get American pizza in Italy now.
Yes. Right. Like exactly. Yeah.
The way these things transform over time and how it becomes, but the way assimilation is two directional, right? We think of assimilation in the negative sense as like you give up your culture and you lose it. a lot of what Jonathan is doing is proving case by case that no, it's additive. It contributes, it morphs, it evolves in a lot of ways, and it becomes part of the other thing. The way the Three Stooges are part of American culture, the same way that salsa is the number one condiment in America. Where 30 years ago, guacamole was impossible to find. Now you get it everywhere, right? These are the way things transform, and that happens. This was made during the main talk, is that like it's a secularizing process. And that is super important for us when assimilation becomes secularizing. So I appreciated that. Nathan, anything else? Any other great takeaways?
No, just that we'll include a link down below. Check out Amusing Jews.
Mm-hmm. AU Studios. Yes. AUS Unite. Mm-hmm. So check them out. If you've got a few ducats lying around, pitch them their way. They're doing great work out in LA and soon across America.
Yeah. Just want to thank the Patreon supporters.
Yes.
Check out, if you want to become a supporter, we've got bonus content available.
Yes.
Otherwise, like and subscribe, rate and review.
Right.
We'd really appreciate it.
Seeing those numbers going up. More patrons, more likes and subscribes. They always help us out. And the like and subscribe is free. That's even better. Smash that button. I think that's it. Red Japan, big ups. Thanks for the music. And until next time.